presenting UBC Digest. Good afternoon, everyone. Once again, the University Radio Society greets you from its studios here on the campus. This is UBC's own program, produced entirely by Radio Society members. During this series, we hope to make you better acquainted with the activities of your university. If you're interested in UBC, we think you'll enjoy this afternoon's program. UBC Digest, Volume 2, Number 12. Democracy ran rampant at UBC this past week as the first installment of student elections got underway last Wednesday. Students went to the polls to select their choice of a president and secretary to look after the government next year amid the usual hubbub and ballyhoo of campaigning that is an integral part of any election. URS reporter Ron Robinson was on hand as the ballots were counted Wednesday night, and here is his tape-recorded report direct from the boardroom of Brock Hall.
As you may know, the preferential ballot is being used in all student elections again this year. Another point which makes the chest of the average UBC student swell with justifiable pride is that UBC undergraduates are recognized as having a phenomenal amount of student autonomy and self-regulation. In fact, it has been said, whether truthfully or slightly exaggerated, I couldn't exactly say, but I have heard it said many times that UBC students have more autonomy, that is, without faculty intervention, more autonomy than any other university in North America. So you can see that our student counselors-elect have great tradition and reputation to uphold. And each of the four candidates who are on today's ballot for the presidential post, each of them seems to be aware of the responsibilities of holding student office. Well, I see the counting of ballots is just about ready to wind up here this evening. By the way, to get this report, we've been closeted in here with the ballot counters for the past 4 hours or so, while they've been going through the arduous procedure of elimination and recounting that is peculiar to the single transferable ballot system. We should be able to get the results in just a moment from the chairman of the elections committee, Jim McNish, who's been in charge of supervising the campaign, and quite a lively campaign, too, I might say, during the past week. As a matter of fact, to give you a little example, last Monday noon we recorded the remarks of each of the candidates as they made campaign speeches before a large crowd in the UBC auditorium. And herewith, we're going to present highlights of their platforms as outlined there. First, Albert Plant, a third-year commerce student who suggested students should take over operation of the university bookstore.
When there was 3 feet of snow on the campus, Dr. McKenzie told the press that he didn't want to close this campus because it was a working institution. That is very correct. Why then can't we students help to work it? An investigation into the Treasury could easily show that a student-owned bookstore could be effectively and profitably organized and operated.
Next in line was Miss Wendy Sutton. This is something a bit unusual in the presidential race, as the women usually leave the highest UBC student office up to the men. But UBC males have had it made clear to them that they no longer hold a monopoly on that post. Miss Sutton, a third-year art student and incidentally editor of this year's Totem Yearbook, spoke of the drive for additional student housing on the campus.
I will make every effort to assist in this program and will pledge full cooperation with the university administration in its drive to obtain financial aid for increased student housing facilities.
Dick Underhill, third candidate for office, is in second-year law and is vice president of this year's council. He mentioned three possible types of student councils.
There are perhaps good, bad, and indifferent councils. And I think you'll find that you'll find the good councils had a good president in charge. And you'll find that the good presidents, the best presidents, were those who've had some council experience before and know what the students' council and the students of this university need.
Conducting the most colorful campaign during this election week was Clive Nylander, another second-year law student whose sole claim to fame seemed to be his unusual nickname, Baru, spelled B-A-R-U. His campaign was based mostly on puns on this name and included such far-fetched items as My Baru Heaven, The West and Est in Baru Deer, and many others quite similar. He made mention of what he thought was needed to guide student affairs effectively.
This takes more than just good intentions. It takes hard work, plus, and I say plus, imagination. I'm sure that all my fellow candidates here will work hard. But how many of them have imagination? Now, why do I say imagination is a necessity? Because ideas depend upon imagination.
And when asked to comment on the controversial Ostrom plan for aid to athletics, which has been in effect at UBC for the past 3 years, Mr. Nylander made good use of his latent imagination.
Speaking on that, I'd say that half my friends are for it and half my friends are against it, and I'm behind my friends 100%.
Well, today, of course, the laughter and cheering and shouting subsided as students went to the polls to elect their new president. And right now, I see the results of today's election are completed. The counting of the polls has been finished, and now I'm going to ask Jim McNish, chairman of the elections committee, to announce the result. Jim?
Well, Dick Underhill beat out Wendy Sutton on the last count, that being the third count. The final total was 1816 to 1239. The total count thereby being 3,100 votes.
3,100 votes out of a total enrollment of 5,300 students here. I believe that works out to a percentage of a 59% turnout.
That's right.
Would you say that was pretty good?
Yes, that compares to a vote of previous years of about 38%.
Well, that's indeed very favorable. You've been in charge of the campaign for the past week. Would you care to make any comment on the conduct of it?
Well, I feel that the students have created no real infraction of the election rules. However, I do believe that our large vote this year was primarily due to the exuberance in which the students entered into the presidential and secretarial races.
After chatting with Jim McNish, we rushed to the telephone to contact the victorious Mr. Underhill, who was attending a dance party in North Vancouver.
Hello, Dick, and congratulations on winning the presidential elections for the coming year, 1954-55.
Hello there, Ron. How are you?
Fine. Would you care to make a statement on your victory, Dick?
Well, I'm certainly very pleased and very flattered to have the support of the students, which I got at the election.
Would you say that the campaign has been run fairly and squarely for all candidates?
I certainly think it has. It's been one of the best fought and one of the most interesting campaigns there have been this year.
Dick, what do you think will offer you the stoutest challenge in your new position this year?
I think the financial problems of the AMS will probably constitute the biggest headache for all of us, as they have in the past years.
Well, thank you very much, Dick, and the best of luck to you.
And there you have our report on elections from UBC. Thanks, Ron, for a very thorough coverage of the first installment of UBC elections. Remember, next Wednesday, UBC students vote for treasurer, president of Men's and Women's Athletic Directorates, president of the Women's Undergraduate Society, and for first member at large. More about that next week. You're listening to UBC Digest, Volume 2, Number 12, a program of and about your university, produced entirely by student members of the University Radio Society. February is fast proving itself the busiest month for UBC students, for not only do they have elections to worry about, but they also are asked to donate a pint of blood to the spring term's annual blood drive. The blood drive started on Wednesday of last week in the UBC Armories, and to keep you up to date, we bring you now a special report on the blood drive from the staff of Red Cross workers on duty in the Armories.
Well, I'm the supervisor of the blood donor clinic at the Armories. My name is Mrs. Case, and I would like to take on a tour to explain to you the different procedure as regards the blood donors in the clinic. And I think if we start right now with the lady with the coat, she's the first one. I would like to introduce Mrs. Jones. She is the lady that is the first one to greet our donor with a smile and to help them to give them confidence. She gives them a coat which replaces the sugar that is taken out of the blood. And then from there we proceed to our technician. We now come to the technician. She will take over from here and explain what she does.
Mrs. Field, well, when the person comes here to donate blood, take one drop of their blood and test their hemoglobin to see if they're in good health, and then test their grouping, see what group blood group they are. Well, you just prick their finger with a little needle, just take the one drop, and then drop the drop of blood into copper sulfate, and if it sinks, the person is healthy and not anemic. If it floats, they're not.
The next thing the donor does is to be registered. Mrs. Adamson will now explain.
I ask the names, address, birth date, if they've had malaria, jaundice, or blood transfusion.
We now come to the hostess, and one of the very important parts of the clinic. She really is quite important, Mrs. Delanoy. Well, after they've been typed and registered, I direct them to the bed and just any empty bed that's there, I just direct them to it.
We are now inside the clinic where they really do the job of taking the blood. This nurse here would explain what she does.
Oh, this is June Eisler, and we assist the nurses to help put the needle in and also help take it out and help the donor off the bed, talk to them while they're giving blood. Some people feel quite nervous about it, and we're known as VAVs, which we're just assistants to the nurses.
I would like to introduce you to our nurse in charge of the clinic. She's Miss Hurst. She can explain everything for me.
Well, the nurses are the ones that just put the needle in your arm. It really doesn't hurt too much. Just put a little bit of freezing in and then the big needle and then let you drip for a while and take it off. But
we now come to the stage where the blood has been taken from the donor and it is now in its bottles. And it's from now on, the nurse will explain what she does.
My name is Anna Rample. We are setting up the bottles here before they get to the donors, and the donors fill them up, and they are returned to this table here, and the needle is taken out of the bottle again, and the lid is put on the bottle again and put away into crate.
I would like to introduce Major Freeman. He is the director of our panel and does all the organizing for all these blood donor clinics, and he really works very hard. Without him, we couldn't get on at all. Major Freeman.
So far, in the 8 days that we've been out here, we've had 2,550 donors, averaging 320 per day. Our target is 3,600.
Well, I'm Mrs. Case, the supervisor of blood donor clinics, and we've now completed our tour of the blood donors clinic, and we are very grateful to all the boys for coming in from the universities they have, but we would really like to finish off the clinic, the fortnight clinic, on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, and I do hope you'll all come along, as we do need the blood so badly.
Well, next week, after having exercised their franchise and having given freely of their life substance, students on the Point Grey campus can relax to sweet music. Yes, the Musical Society's annual spring production is with us again, and the cast is holding their dress rehearsal right now in the auditorium. URS Special Events Man Ross Crane is on hand over there now, so we transfer controls to the UBC Auditorium and the Musical Society Chorus.
We're backstage here at the rehearsal of the Musical Society's spring production, The Red Mill. I knew I'd think of it. The Red Mill by Victor Herbert. And we happen to have with us backstage Mr. John Chappelle. Is that right?
That's right.
Well, John, we'll ask you something about The Red Mill itself, about the plot. I imagine we're all interested in knowing the story before we go to see it. So can you give us a few highlights about it?
Well, I imagine the main plot is between these two American tourists who are doing Europe the easy way by, any time they can't pay their hotel bill, they skip out the window.
Well, what period is this? Is this modern times or way back when?
No, this is around about the turn of the century.
And they were trying to do Europe on nothing then, eh?
Right. They get stopped in Holland, mixed up in a sort of a love triangle, or a four-sided triangle. There is a governor who is supposed to marry a young girl named Gretchen, who is, in turn, in love with a Peter Van Schuyler. However, the governor doesn't really love Gretchen. He is actually after her Aunt Bertha. But there's a question of a dowry, which all has to be settled before the governor can marry.
Who is in the cast of the Red Mill?
Well, Gretchen is played by Joan Black, and Peter Van Schuyler is Brian Cooper.
Uh-huh.
The governor is Bob Clark, and Bertha is played by Joyce Rohr.
Fine. How about these two Americans?
These two Americans are Jerry LeCoven and myself.
Oh, you're in the production as well as being production manager. You're also playing one of the leads.
Oh, I should mention Tina.
Tina?
Who is played by Barbara Gwither. Mm-hmm. At least, I should say Barbara Dupre.
Good. Well, we've mentioned the cast and the students that are in here. By the way, is this entirely a student production?
Well, as far as the cast goes, they're all students, but there's our music director is Harry Price of CBC.
Yes.
And Mr. E.V. Young is our drama director. Uh-huh. And Grace McDonald is doing our choreography.
Well, I don't think we have much time left. It looks like they're calling for you on stage, so let's just get the important facts. The production is next week, is that right?
Next week. It starts Monday night.
And there are student performances on the 15th through to the 17th, is that right? Monday, Tuesday,
no,
and Wednesday?
No, just the 15th and 17th.
Oh, just 15th and 17th. That's Monday and Wednesday, and then Thursday the public's invited.
Thursday, Friday, and Saturday is for the public.
And what's the admission, John?
The public is a dollar and a quarter, and a dollar and a half.
Well, we wish you every success in your production, John, and we'll let you get back on stage, and
fine,
I think we'll listen to
much.
Another fine tune from the Red Mill.
Righto.
Thanks to the Musical Society and a special events man, Roth Crane, for bringing us that bit of news on the Musical Society's presentation of the Red Mill. And now, let's see what the ladies are doing. It seems that the Women's Organization for Terry's has elected a new president. And here to chat with the lucky girl is URS Women's reporter, Marg Weems.
Today, the president-elect, Maureen Sankey, and I are going to tell you parents of Fraternities and prospective Fraternities about Fraternities. First, Maureen, perhaps you could tell us just what Fraternities is.
Well, Fraternities is a girls' organization here on the campus for promoting friendship among the girls, especially the girls who are from out of town and from all the schools here in the city of Vancouver.
Well, it does serve a great purpose in getting the girls who are new to the city and don't have too many friends, getting them to meet people and to be able to go to social service parties where they can feel they're doing some good as well as going to university and get into the social swing of things too, doesn't it?
Oh, that's right.
The organization, perhaps I'd be best to tell them about that, seeing as how I am a subchapter president. The organization is divided into various groups called subchapters, and this year there are seven. It depends upon the number of girls that are initiated as to how many subchapters there are. Now, Maureen, you correct me if I say anything wrong.
Oh, you're right so far.
And each of these subchapters has at the head of it a subchapter president. And these subchapters have various functions which they perform. They are active in sport. They do social service for various organizations, and they have social functions as well, such as going to dinner and just filling yourself so full you can't move for about three quarters of an hour afterwards. Well, now, you tell the people about camp, too, Maureen, because you've been more often than I have.
We have camp at the end of the Terry's. We don't just stop when school stops. After school's out and we've had our exams, they're all rather exhausted, we all go off to camp, which is this year going to be at Camp Furcum, we hope. And there we have just a relaxing time to sit around and read and cook and do whatever we like for either a weekend or for about 5 days.
Well, I hope that you people listening to us speak about Fraternities today have learned something about the organization.
The subject of book burning and freedom of knowledge has been quite a widely discussed topic of late. And to get the university's slant on the subject, we went to the UBC librarian, Mr. Neil Harlow. He gave us this statement.
Preserving the freedom to read is in the public interest. It is necessary to democracy. All attempts by private individuals to censor books, restrict liberties of thought and expression upon which our lives and institutions are based. Our society thrives upon freedom. It will be elastic and tough as long as we are free to make personal choices and to advocate social change. We must, as individuals, maintain that freedom against all offers or threats to protect us from what other points of view may conceive to be bad or dangerous. Books are important to freedom. They are almost the only means through which to express a new idea or to develop thought. And through bookstores and libraries, they are made widely available for use. In a university, we have books about abnormal psychology and disease, but we do not teach people to be either abnormal or ill, but train them to recognize and to cure such conditions. Public libraries should have books representing a wide diversity of views and expressions. And to keep this country free, every community must ensure its own liberty by jealously defending the existing freedoms to read, to know, and to understand.
Thank you, Mr. Harlow. And now it's sports time in the Digest. Here's news of hockey at UBC with Radio Society sportscaster Bob Bergen.
Good afternoon, sport fans. Today we have with us Gordon Mundell, manager of the UBC hockey team. Well, Gordy, I guess you must have quite a time fielding a team here at UBC compared to some of the universities in the other provinces where hockey is played quite a bit more, eh?
Well, actually, no, Bob. We have quite a few fellows here from the prairies and from the interior where hockey is played quite extensively. Although most universities have their own rink right on the campus, that is about our biggest hindrance where we have to go downtown for our ice services.
Well, I suppose this trip to Colorado that's coming up pretty soon has lured quite a few more players out onto the ice for varsity than usual, eh?
Well, actually, Bob, no. Most fellows who come from the prairies and from the interior like to play hockey well enough that they would turn out for any team that is going. But, of course, I would say yes, too, that anyone who has a possible chance of going on such a trip would come out and play any sport taking such a trip.
Well, would you tell us something about the itinerary of this trip, Gordon?
Well, we leave here this year on March the 2nd. We fly from here to Seattle and take a plane from Seattle to Denver. We play in Denver on the 3rd and on the 5th. Then we fly from Denver to Colorado Springs, where we play on the 6th and the 8th.
And who do you play down there? What university do you play?
In Denver, we play Denver University, and at Colorado Springs, we play Colorado College.
And what kind of teams have they got down there? How is hockey organized in there? Do they have junior leagues like they do here, or how do they get the players?
Their players are scholarship players from Canada. Of the two teams that we will be playing, one fellow, ironically enough, comes from the States, and he comes from Miami, Florida. However, most of the players do come from Canada, and they play in an intercollegiate league there.
Uh-huh. And shortly, I see you're going to play against the University of Alberta right here in Vancouver. Just when is this series going to be played?
February the 22nd and 23rd. It's Monday and Tuesday night.
The winners of the games will receive the Hamber Trophy, right?
Right.
And just what is this trophy?
Well, the Hammer Trophy was donated, or at least given, to this series by the Honorable Hammer. And Mr. Hammer was a former president of the university here.
I see. Well, thank you very much for coming down here this afternoon, Gordon. And good luck to you and the hockey team in this forthcoming series.
And that's the last page of UBC Digest, Volume 2, Number 12. Thanks go to the fellows in the control room who helped to make this afternoon show possible. Ross Crane in charge of production and Don Fraser on the controls. Next week at this time, we'll all be back with another program direct from the campus of your university. We hope you'll be with us then. Until next Saturday at 2:05, this is Fred Rare speaking on behalf of the University Radio Society, wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon from the University of British Columbia. This is URS, the University Radio Society, the voice of UBC.